Dacus, the Greek writer who gave us Zorba the Greek and other works, relates in his story, A Report to Greco. In it, he speaks about one of the latter Neoplatonists in the 5th century, Proclus, and gives an example, I think, that sort of gives a sweep of the history from the times of pre-Socratic Greece with the pantheon of Mount Olympus through the historical changes that Greece and the areas adjacent to it went through over some time in history. The story goes that, of course, you know from mythology probably that Athena, the great goddess, is reputed to have sprung through the forehead of Zeus, her father. And the story goes that Proclus, on a rainy night in Greece, had a knock on his door, and he went to the door and was surprised to find Pallas Athena there at the door in the rain. She walked in and said, "I've been everywhere all through Greece. Nobody accepts me anymore. I'd like to seek refuge in your forehead." And I think with that kind of sweep, I think at least one thing it illustrates is that in this period of time, some thousand or so years, that again, the relationship between the pantheon in Greece of the Greek myths and Greek philosophy, and then what was to happen through the expansion of Alexander, and then through the rise of the Roman state, and then finally through the slow rising of Christianity, all are ingredients in a time that when we get to what is normally considered the standard Neoplatonists from 3rd century through 6th century, we're in an age which Dodds, the scholar from Oxford, borrowed his friend and poet Auden's notion about our time, namely an age of anxiety. And we have a time where things were in turmoil all through the world, and it's not totally clear why. But what I'd like to do today to try to do some ambitious things, being a theosophist, I thought I'd try to do 7 things. I don't know if we could do it. But my first thing is to try to some way explain sort of a personal interest that brings this subject up and how it connects personally with my discovery of theosophy and HBB and the key to theosophy. Then to talk, secondly, you have the one obnoxious handout, which I'm not going to make you go through all of these things, of course, at this time, but I'm going to try to explain from her book, The Key to Theosophy, who are the analogeticists and the Philolathians, what that meant, and give some sense of how that fits with the theme. The third is to, in some way, draw a few examples from the Skelton Key, to theosophy, some quotes from the key, which I think, again, illustrate the methods and the relationship to the earlier thinkers known as Neoplatonists. Finally, then, to go through some chronology of the major figures from Ammoniacus through Hypatia. And these will be fairly brief kinds of aspects of it, and remarks about the bibliography of what are some of the things that are in print. And then to get ambitious, I want to try to, at the end, go through the fifth thing to see how all this relates to our three objects of the TS. And then the sixth, to the three fundamental propositions that HPB speaks of in the Secret Doctrine. And then finally, if you last that long and still have energy, you'll be welcome to see a short video on Plato's Cave that I hope will bring together a number of the things that I'm trying to illustrate about these people and their relevance, I think, to today. Now, to start out with, then, the first of the seven is on the personal note. When I was a junior, the summer I was a junior in high school, I'd had some interest in philosophy. I didn't have any standard kind of religious background and denomination, and sort of felt somewhat, you know, alienated from my peers, and had known that my father, who hadn't been baptized, had grown up in, first of all, in a kind of a mining town in Illinois, and he remembers always being, you know, very hurt when he was called a pagan by people who acknowledged that he had never been baptized. So ironically, of course, when I got baptized, my father got baptized, so he thought that was, he was doing me a favor that he had never received. And I think, interestingly enough, it was to then set a kind of vision, which I think by, you know, if you grew up in America through Cecil B. DeMille films and other kinds of secular sources to tell you about Jesus, well, certainly the pagans never seemed to be, you know, good guys. They always seemed to be somehow, you know, less enlightened, and I could understand why my father, you know, was concerned about, you know, being discriminated against in his old neighborhood. But at the same time, as I you know, grew to do some thinking, I found myself much more at home with these pagans that we'll be talking about than I did necessarily within organized religion. But anyway, in this experience in my junior year, if any of you have ever been to the mountain range here in Illinois, I don't know if any of you know have been there, but it's a couple counties down on Route Interstate 55, past Will County, where you have places like Coal City. I don't know if you've been there, but this was the old strip mining territory that my grandfather had, when he first came to America, had worked, and my father grew up. And so from the strip mines, they have various hills that developed that, you know, ironically, you know, look like little, you know, miniature toy mountains. And they have, you know, various little lakes and little rivulets there, and at that time, you know, it was an adventure to go down to the old coal mines, and because some of the swimming things, it was pretty deep water, and always kinds of warnings. But this was a way, at least, of getting into nature for me at that point. And one time, I went out with a number of my friends, and when we parted our ways in different places, and I remember sitting atop of one of these grand mountains, these little hills, probably about maybe 75 feet most in terms of sea level, above sea level. And I had a very unusual experience that was very, very, you know, just powerful to me, something that I had never experienced in that way before. And without getting into, you know, psychological confessions and anything else like that, I think at best it was something that was very carried with it a very positive valence, a sense of affection for the world as it was, a sense of there being, you know, some significance and meaning to life, and a sense particularly since at that time as a teenager I was working in areas about human relations in this area, working with you know, kids of different races at that time, which was kind of pioneering. And a sense, again, of somehow the kind of brotherhood of humanity, sense of connection. I knew better than to tell any of my friends about this experience because, you know, if my father had been really taunted by people as a pagan, these people would have thought I was totally nuts. But I reflected on experience because it had an effect on me for a couple days. And I wondered, you know, is this what people are going to talk about, an experience of God or divinity and whatever? Well, I never resolved it. All I did was classify it as an unusual experience. And I continue to do so. It was an unusual experience. And it was an experience that I didn't really have a sense of really finding other souls or kindred spirits who would elucidate similar things till I got to college and started reading through Plato, and then particularly reading Plotinus, one of the Neoplatonists we'll get to. In it, that's where I found the sense that there were, you know, various states of consciousness in which we could participate in, and, you know, when we were there, that there was a different kind of metaphysical vantage point. Again, I'm always, you know, Nietzsche and other people always make me weary of saying that I had a mystical experience, but I had something at least that made me, I think, understand those who had mystical experiences. So that's the best I'm willing to say about it, because there was something that had such a profound sense. And in it, I think one of the things about the language and the vision that is conveyed by those thinkers that fall in the Platonist, Neoplatonist camp is the sense of there being an ascent. And it's comical to me to see me on a little hill about 75 feet in a mine, but here we're talking about going upward, you know, 40,000 feet higher, getting that sense of a upward metaphor, which, you know, for those of us who have a sense of the chakras from the Eastern Indian situation, is the sense of, you know, getting upward, getting out of some of the more mundane aspects of our being to things that are higher. Now, in my freshman year is where I discovered in particular the vision that I have here on video, the allegory of the cave. Have many of you read that or encountered that as such? It's certainly one of the most, I think, frequently referred to or alluded to visions in Western philosophy. And, you know, Plato was trying to, I think, again, convey and utilize a visual metaphor that would get us to look at things in terms of shadows, copies, imitations, inferior representations, material representations, and then finally the more abstract formations, which he would call forms, or eidos, or morphe, as such. In it, then, in the Republic, where it comes, the sense is that this territory, these states of consciousness, are traversed by the philosopher, who, you know, using reasoning as well as kind of a moral discipline and ethical relation to others in the polis, gradually, in a sense, creates the conditions for the states of consciousness to elevate, to go up. The alternative kind of rendition in Plato of the same thing is in the Symposium, the famous discussion of love, in which the old midwife who is said to have taught Socrates, Diadema, tells him about this ladder of ascent in which you go from, you know, loving concrete material things to loving people, to then being able to really love laws and order and beauty, and then finally to be able to, again, participate in this form of goodness and love that is of the higher region. And I think it's interesting to remember this this vision of love, because in one place in the latter work of Blavatsky, she asks us, you know, to reconsider the way we often in the West think of the word philosophy, which is normally translated as the love of wisdom. And she flips it around and suggests that, as in the case of Diadema here, the issue is the wisdom of love, the wisdom of being able to reach those states of consciousness in which love becomes more and more inclusive as such. But anyway, there is a sense then within HPB that I think links to the tradition. And when I first came and started studying philosophy in the Kita Theosophy work that was published in 1889, I was immediately drawn in just the first few pages, because she was making reference to the lineage in the West to Plato and Plotinus and Ammoniosacchus, the Neoplatonists, that same tradition that had moved me. So I had the sense when I came to the library down there that I had come home, and when I found that, I thought, well, you know, here's some more signs of coming home. So this would be, again, sort of covering the first territory that I want to, is that the sense then that within this tradition that goes from Plato through Proclus, or even later, as we'll talk about, there's an ongoing kind of stressing of certain types of experience over others. And I think one of the things that's important to say that those who were Neoplatonists, as we're going to call them, they wouldn't have used such a label. That label came out much later by some German scholars, I think, in the 18th century. But to them, they were in the Platonic tradition, but they were studying all sorts of things. They were studying not only Plato, they were studying whatever came down the pike. So that I think, again, when you look at later as we go to the second object, which encourages the study of comparative religion, philosophy, and science, is that this is the way these various groups in different cities all operated. They were not just reading only Plato. They were reading Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics and the Epicureans and the Cynics and, you know, you name it. It came down the line. And yet there was a certain reverence and position of lineage that they connected themselves to. And I think particularly that lineage then was not so much one of being critical of Plato, in a sense, of when they would come to differ him, but felt that they were trying to clarify him, trying to, in a sense, extend him to different areas of thought. So that, in general, the grouping is pretty much, since their own, you know, not all of the dialogues were preserved through history, that those groups that communicated were drawing on those dialogues that did exist. Certainly some of the things that Aristotle, Plato's student, commented on, having been at the direct lectures. And then later there was the sense of an oral tradition that was being conveyed with some secrecy from things that Plato had said that then somehow got conveyed that we don't know. So I think it's in this element then to get to the second part, the issue about Philalethians and analogeticists. Well, this is very early in this first few pages of the key in identifying the modern theosophist lineage to these thinkers. H.P. Bigos and says they were called, among other things, theosophists, Philalethians, lovers of truth, and also analogeticists, because they tended, again, to utilize metaphor, analogy, as the means of expressing and conveying important truths. Now, the Philalethians issue, and I mean, for those of you, again, who know the motto of the society, which is there's no religion higher than truth, and HBB points out that connection to the Philalethians, that sense of the search for truth, but on the sense of the relationship of the analogeticists, I just had some examples that I just wanted to show you quickly so that we know what we're talking about as such, because the idea is that metaphor and analogy are methods of what HBB would say of awakening spiritual intuitions. These are ways of expressing things that cannot be expressed in terms of quantity mathematically, but that in a sense our nature is such in terms of our experience, this can be receptive, that we can understand them in ways. So wherever you have metaphor and analogy, you don't have perfect correspondence, but you have language, you know, being used in some way to convey something that otherwise is more complex. Just I want to just put look at two of these on the second page here. One by Martin Rees and Joseph Silk, who are a couple of 20th century astronomers. They write, perhaps the most startling discovery made in astronomy this century is that the universe is populated by billions of galaxies and that they are systematically receding from one another like raisins in an expanding pudding. Doesn't that convey it? I mean, do you have to have a mathematical formulae? Do you have to have that gives you the image and the understanding. Just as in a very materialistic sense, the one above it by Carl Vogt, who's a physiologist, says the brain secretes thought as the stomach secretes gastric juice, the liver bile, and the kidneys urine. Now that's the opposite of Platonism right there. There you have a pretty materialistic explanation, but still trying to draw on some metaphors. And finally, the one I'll draw is from George Pitcher talking about Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein used to compare thinking with swimming. Just as in swimming, our bodies have a natural tendency to float on the surface so that it requires great physical exertion to plunge to the bottom, so in thinking, it requires great mental exertion to force our minds away from the superficial down into the depth of a philosophical problem. So once again, I think conveying is something that we understand in one term, in one area, to another as such. And this is a method you'll find throughout those writers. But that's not all. I mean, again, they're going to tie it to various forms of reasoning and logic as well. Now, one other aspect in these first few chapters that HBB brings up, because she calls particularly the Ammonius Saccas, who we'll get to, the founder of this eclectic school in Alexandria, as having an object to reconcile all religions, sects, and nations under a common system of ethics based on eternal verities. To teach ethics by example and exercise, and I think again she makes it clear that this is another way of phrasing an underlying objective of the TS, is to find a form of that kind of reconciliation and to deal with it in this manner, to teach, you know, by example and exercise rather than to present a dogma as such. So I'll leave you for the, someone asked me how much time you have for the recommended readings. Well, you know, I'd say that's certainly up to you. This was used for a different purpose, so I just thought I'd imply it. So thirdly, just to get into the mission then about the secret, about the key to theosophy, which is, as I mentioned, had come out in 1889 after the secret doctrine. And in the secret doctrine, where there was a great reliance on language of India, Sanskrit, images from all over, though, one of the things she had seen it as in her title, her subtitle, is to be a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy, and to assign man his rightful place in the scheme of the universe, being a purpose. Now, in that context, in particular, the Platonic corpus had been translated in English by Jowett, which many of you probably read Jowett's translations and are still used. And they were published starting in the 1870s and 80s, and Jowett was someone who felt, to use HBB's word, that all this business about mystery schools and mysticism and this various kind of symbolic language of the so-called esoteric schools, you know, was all flapdoodle. And that that it was, you know, that wasn't the case, that these were great, you know, concrete things that were very to be taken literally, and that HBB, in a sense, has devoted quite a bit of time, and what we have is volume 14 of the collected works, so it's trying to attack the demystification of Plato as such. She was drawing on, by the way, one of her sort of sources, Alexander Wilder, who published a document on the Neoplatonists, which was called the New Platonists at the time, and he was in that same field, so there was a lot of connection between the two of them all through the time of ISIS, through the 1880s as such. But anyway, I think what HBB was trying to do at that time in the key to try to stress the Western tradition and our connection in the West was that it was a key kind of turning point to her. It was a time again when, in terms of the rise of materialism as it was coming out, was providing, you know, sort of presenting a picture that humanity or each human was really alone and isolated in static and in sort of indifferent universe, that nobody cared, the kind of materialistic view of the time. And she was trying to say that this true position, the rightful place of humanity, was one in which each of us was vitally interconnected in an evolving universe, and that these things were very, very important for us to understand in order to, in a sense, be able to shift to the higher states of consciousness. I think this, you know, Joy Mills, one of our contemporaries, sort of sees the issue in sometimes, she puts it, that, you know, the need for us to fall in love with humanity and its possibilities, that that was what was being conveyed, getting a sense that if we knew what our right place was in the universe and that there was, in a sense, this evolving perspective, we would make the higher choices. We would find that as a priority as such. And I think it's this kind of element that is reflected in her presentation on Theosophy that is represented, I think, in these 19 quotes that I have in this one. I'm not going to go through all of these either, but just to relate them to what we've already talked about. Number two, in terms of the Philatians, those who have imagined Theosophy to be a new religion have hunted in vain for its creed and its ritual. Its creed is loyalty to truth, and its ritual to honor every truth by use. There, again, is the, I think, sense to that connection. Now, the second one, number three here, we assert that the divine spark in man, being one and identical in its essence with the universal spirit, our spiritual self, is practically omniscient, but that it cannot manifest its knowledge owing to the impediments of matter. Once again, I think as we get into the next section, when we go back to the Platonists, this is the sense that the material universe is not necessarily bad, but it gets in the way. And particularly, you know, in the situation where she's writing, it's a time where people aren't even knowing necessarily that there are higher states anymore to reach. And so the notion that if you have these impediments removed, things of the kind of experiences that mystics convey are also things then that would be accessible to humans. Number eight, to resort once more to metaphor, Theosophy on Earth is like the white ray of the spectrum, and every religion only one of the seven prismatic colors. So again, trying to stress the unifying dimension as such in the Theosophical tradition. Finally, just one other one that I'll draw on is number 11. It is a mystery, rather, an occult process by which finite and conditioned thoughts and desires, unable to be assimilated by the absolute spirit, which is unconditioned, are translated into spiritual wills and the will, such process being called spiritual transmutation. The intensity of our ardent aspirations changes prayer into the philosopher's stone, or that which transmutes lead into pure gold. Now, that's making allusions to, you know, the alchemical notion of trying to, again, go from the baseness of material being represented in terms of lead to raise it into gold. Jokingly, I said, I was telling Chuck early on that those of you who are into rock and roll, if you've ever heard the Led Zeppelin, which is a great platonic image in itself, their song, The Stairway to Heaven, that whole notion there deals with questions of gold and ascent as well. So I don't know, we'll wait until Stefan comes here and decide if that's a Gnostic song or a Neoplatonist song. As such. But nonetheless, I think, again, this notion of transmutation, that we have it within our power through discipline, through living a certain kinds of life, as we would see in our tradition through, again, the study, service, and meditation, a chance to elevate ourselves, rise, revere what's above us, and eventually reach it. So with that, I then want to just... jump along to this quick trip through the Neoplatonists themselves. If you want to jump to the next sheet. From Hemlock to Hypatia, well, that's going to be explained. This is 399 is the date when Socrates is offered the hemlock and voluntarily takes it. And 415 is a reputed date where Hypatia, a Neoplatonist in Alexandria, is reported to have been killed, reported in various ways how she was killed, by a Christian mob in Alexandria, and leading to the decline of tolerance for any kind of Neoplatonic thought. But anyway, so you have this lineage, as I mentioned, going from Plato, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, right through the other chairs that were usually there, as in the University of Rome under Marcus Aurelius. There was a chair for Platonism, a chair for Aristotelianism, chair for the Stoics, and a chair for the Epicureans. But the other three were kind of in a decline. Only the Platonic chair seemed to still be operating. Now, this enters then Ammonius Saccas, whose dates as we have here, who was in Alexandria, was the setting. And he, as HBB, borrowing from Wilder and other sources down the line, we don't have any existent writings from Saccas that were down, but he was seen as one of the major teachers of the time, drew people from all around, and was called the divine taught, that he was taught directly by God. And he had, apparently, again, a very much, his teachings were tied to a secrecy and a mystery school. Plotinus is said to have been searching all through the area for a teacher. And when he found Ammonius Saccas, he knew this was the man, and stayed with him and learned from him. But as it's reported by Plotinus's student Porphyry, who wrote a little biography of Plotinus, that Ammonius Saccas had asked his students to keep his work secret. So the nature of the secrecy, it's hard to say what that might be. But again, it suggests to me, again, ritual and some elements that are not necessarily those things that are transformed by logic or even metaphor, but that would have some experiential base. Plotinus, then, in his school in Rome, was a school that drew widely from the upper-class educated people. There were senators, and certainly the aristocracy came to his classes. And as Porphyry at least relates it, when he showed up as a student himself and found that Plotinus was the man he was looking for, that Plotinus really had not had anything in writing at the time. He was not, again, a philosopher to teach via writing. But Porphyry urged him to do so. And so you have what is available in a couple of different translations in English. It's called the Enneads, E-N-N-E-A-D-S. And these are nine treatises with six sections that Porphyry put together. That's why they're named that way. And they refer to a number of different topics. And as one critic has put it, the only problem with reading Plotinus is that you have to know the philosophy of Plotinus before you can understand it. Now, I wouldn't go that far, but it was clear that what Plotinus did write, which has certain areas, I think, of majestic lucidity in the metaphors and what it's trying to convey. There are other things that you don't always, don't understand the way it all connects as such. But nonetheless, that's the most available work that we have of the tradition, and considered the most important of the works as such. Porphyry, the person following on the list, was a Phoenician whose name was Malchus, and I guess, as the story goes, in Tyre, where he was from, that was the place where they made a lot of purple dye. And so when he came over into Rome, somebody suggested he change his name to Purple, or Porphyry, and he took that on and is known at it. And in Porphyry's case, then, we have someone who was well-respected with a great body of works that were produced, of which few have come down to us. And the reason for there being the few that come down to us is that Porphyry is someone who wrote a treatise that was strongly anti-Christian at the time where Christianity was in the ascent. This work was, we don't have anything of it. It was, all copies were directed to be burned, and along with it, a lot of his other works. Things that are still accessible and in print, things are going in and out of print at a quick rate now, but he's known for having a work that's called the Abstinence from Animal Food, which is a treatise on vegetarianism, and it's very anti-Christian in the sense of, pointing out that the Christians at the time were not abstaining from eating animal food, and suggesting again that this was an obstacle to the states of consciousness that one needs for higher transportation. Now, this listed is available in books and print, and I've tried to get it through a couple sources with no luck. So that means that it's probably out on some places' shelves. But it's a delightfully written book, and I think, again, his personality comes out as someone who has a very practical idea of applying these things. They're not just ideas that are abstract. They're very much meant to guide living. The other work that's available right now is a thing, his letter to his wife Marcellus. On, I guess the full letter is the letter to his wife Marcellus concerning the life of philosophy and the ascent to the gods. And this is, again, an epistle while he was gone to his new wife who he married. I guess she had five children. He was 70 years old. Not a bad timing thing, probably, but he was accused of possibly wanting to marry her for her money. And he defends himself on that one. But the work as a whole, again, the work goes and conveys the sense of the ascent. Once again, the discipline, the right study, the right areas of consciousness that get one to transform. Iamblichus, Caesarian, the dates that we have there. Now, in Iamblichus, you have a kind of a switch. There's a change that starts happening within the movement, I think, that's reflected of what was going on in the age of anxiety. As scholars, historians talk about that time, is more and more there's a concern that, you know, everyday reason, everyday modes of knowing are no longer sufficient. So there's a search for help through dream analysis, through the various kinds of divination that were available, leading to, you know, Amblicus, who, and in major work that's available from him is called On the Mysteries. You start seeing this shift of interest into what's called theurgy, or the divine work. And in theurgy, you have a use then of ritual that's used to change and not only transform the state, but in certain forms of belief, is to actually bring the gods and bring the divines over. There was the sense from Plato, or even from Socrates, when he spoke of the daemon. The daemon was an intermediary between the human and the divine in this notion. And in when you reach Iamblichus's time, you have the sense that all that discipline that is talked about by Plotinus and Porphyry, the moral discipline, the discipline of food, the social responsibility, that these things can only work for the very few and don't necessarily work as well as the various ceremonies that go on. So again, with theurgical actual operations, a lot of these were mysterious, and yet, again, as scholars point out, they almost invariably dealt with using things like fire and incense and different kinds of sacrifices. In fact, later when we get to Proclus, who was in that lineage of the vegetarian Neoplatonists, is that he eventually had some meat as part of a theurgical ceremony because he felt that would be hypocritical of him not to. So anyway, that's another issue. But you have the switch, though, and when you start looking at these chapters, you no longer have so much, again, a concern of the discipline coming from within, this introspective mode that was spoke of so strongly from Plato and Plotinus, that, again, it becomes an external manipulation as such. Finally, then, I had mentioned Proclus, who Athena was prone to visit sometime in the 5th century in Athens. He was, again, a systematizer of the previous work. He's seen, again, by many of the critics as second to Plotinus in really being sharp. And Plotinus is sometimes seen as the last of the great ancient philosophers before Descartes. That, you know, that this was somebody that really did have stature. But in Proclus, you have some, what we have existing are a number of commentaries on Plato's dialogues, where he takes passages, and I'm slowly going to be going through these things as I, you know, reread Plato. And he also then was known for the Elements of Theology, a work that systematized some of the work that preceded him, and sort of tried to, again, convey to a situation where people were more and more becoming Christians, and more of the power was becoming Christian, the more ancient tradition. So, roughly at that point, just to say what's going on, then, when you have Hypatia in 415, then, this is so often seen symbolically, and HPB saw it, as the real beginning of the decline, you know, for the ancient wisdom, the ancient thought, that it now was being persecuted wherever it could be. And so you have the persecution then extending into the 6th century, where the Plato's Academy in Athens is finally shut down, and there's a ban on all teaching of the pagan philosophers. And then roughly it comes to an end in Alexandria in about 642, when the Arabs come in and take care of the library and do other things as such. Now, just jumping to some of the other names here briefly, is that what you had then, the pagan Neoplatonists as such, clearly had effect on Christian thinkers, on Jewish thinkers, and on Islamic thinkers as such. We know Augustine, and I guess the old label used to be called him Baptized Plato, right? And then they called St. Thomas the Baptized Aristotle. But Augustine, again, is trying to then work the material that he's inherited into the Christian mode. And you see this apparently in all of the thinkers. It's not such a monolithic aspect. You have people in different ways being influenced and synthesizing different thinking. But to jump to the time here that I have, the next jump really into the 15th century, where Ficino in Italy is asked by Medici to start translating some of the texts that they find on Neoplatonism. And these texts then led to the thrust of what we know of as the Renaissance, Pico, of course, being his collaborator at that point. And then again, just to mention a few names of the people who have identified with the works then that came through. Wordsworth, Blake, poet and painter, Coleridge, Yeats, who's a good old TS member, philosophers, Peirce, Bergson, Whitehead. And interestingly enough, I think in our period of time in America, the two sources that have drawn a lot on the Neoplatonists are two psychologists with a Jungian connection, both James Hillman and Thomas More. In Hillman's work that we studied, some of us studied here on the, what was it of the soul?
The Soul's Code.
The Soul's Code, right. I keep forgetting the title of that. It's not encoded right in my mind. But The Soul's Code is a real standard thing in which he utilizes the a notion of the daemon, the guide of our next level of being, trying to guide us onward to develop. And not always in a pleasant sense. In a sense, we're being, again, the intermediaries are there to, as I think it was Aeschylus says, the fates drag the willing and lead the willing and they drag the unwilling. Well, that it's that kind of thing, that the messages, if we heed them, allow for us to go upward. If not, we end up being dragged for a while. Some of the common themes on all of these people that they would share is the belief in the immateriality of reality, in the sense that we're not dealing with just the material substratum as the source of things, in a sense of a material evolution. Their again tendency is to think of thought and consciousness as primary. And then in some cases, there are a lot of different debates about these things where material, or what we would think of as the material, that is not even necessarily created as such, that it's something that can be eternal in some ways. But the notion is that it's through thought, through consciousness, and through, again, intuition as we go up in areas of apprehension, that we really develop. And I think one thing that just to mention that, whereas if you study Plato, both from Plato's Republic and then other works, the mathematics was very important to him, as well as the political arena. Well, the thing about the Neoplatonists is that you really don't have the same interest anymore in politics. It's more of a sense of an individual going up and elevating, not necessarily coming back to transform the community. Although they were very generous people. I mean, I think, for example, Plotinus was known as running an orphanage, and at one time even had a vision of trying to have an ideal state like the Republic, called Platonopolis, I think it was going to be called, but they couldn't get enough of the Roman senators to finance it. So the second one, the sensible and visible, refer to higher levels of being. And this, again, is what I was saying earlier about the notion of visual metaphors in the dynamic, is that we start out, you know, with the notion of things, and then get the sense that there be all kinds of reflections, shadows, clarity becomes one of the concepts, and the notion that eventually there's that apprehension that's not drawing on the senses anymore, that is a intellectual, intuitive grasping of the higher element. As such, so that again, that what we can draw on in our own experience is to realize that there are these levels. Three, the preference for intuition over empirical methods. Well, this came through, you know, very strongly in the sense that, you know, you use logic, you use reasoning, you use observation, you use metaphor, but it is again the kind of experience that grasps the greater whole that you're at a loss to express, that are the key elements here. So that there's the sense of the visions going upward to the union of the mystic, being guided by that inner understanding as such. The affirmation of the immortality of the soul, well, this again was taken and really not criticized, you know, it gets criticized, but it was pretty much shared throughout. And the sense is that the immortality of the soul can be tied to a sense of reincarnation, which it is in some cases, but not necessarily. The sense is that somehow, again, there is another realm, and that we don't always have a sense of the universe evolving as we might, you know, within the theosophical society. Number five, belief that the universe is good. And I think this is a real important notion. Plotinus, one of his famous papers is against the Gnostics, who were contemporaries. And within the Platonic tradition, the notion that the ideal form is that, you know, what we're living in this world is, you know, but a lesser expression, but nonetheless an expression of this higher divine focus or divine structure. So that the notion of thinking that some of the Gnostics did, that this world was a total disaster, that it was, you know, created by an inferior being who knew no better, and that it was evil, and that it was something that the body was to be detested in any way. You know, these are things that were very alien to Plotinus and the tradition. So for the most part, you know, they were, you know, they knew they wanted to put the body in its right place, but they weren't ascetic and certainly not punitive and certainly not in any way thinking that the universe was evil as such. There was this tendency that you see particularly in Plotinus to, that gets picked up in the Renaissance, about identifying the beautiful and the good and the true. There's the sense in which when we get metaphysically to the notion of the one, that aspect is seen as the form of the good. So that the source that we would see in Theosophy as the absolute, as that source that we can't say anything about it. Well, at least in the Platonic Neoplatonic traditions, is that the sense is that that was a good source. That's not something that's evil as such. Finally, that the 7-1, that there are disciplines for the ascent. And again, as I mentioned, the disciplines being differently expressed, but of course involving what I think we consider as altruism, service to others, moral rectitude, and also, for those the later ones, ritual in some ways is bringing that about. So, just jumping into these last sections that I had hoped to jump to, is okay. What about our three objects and how might they be seen in terms of this group? I use this kind of caricature of the three objects that comes out from the past, from H. and Stokes. And as you know, you've heard us as you come and as you study theosophy, is the first object being to form a nucleus for the formation of the universal brotherhood of humanity. And again, in different expressions without race, creed, sex, caste, color. Very inclusive document. And I think, again, when if you take a look at the what we know of the community of Neoplatonists from the 3rd to the 6th century, there was, again, an amazing sort of tolerance. There was, again, you know, these were philosophers, so they were argumentative. They would certainly, you know, listen to each other and try to find fault or flaws in argument. But overall, I think that little insight that HBB talked about, again, the love of wisdom versus the wisdom of love, the sense was the, an inclusiveness, finding a way to understand, finding a way to convey the truth to those who are not understanding it as such. The second object, again, to encourage the study of writings of comparative religion, philosophy, and science. Again, I think this was clearly dominant in just about all of those communities. There really, again, may have been a preference, just as we, you know, there are those of us in our tradition who prefer Blavatsky, and there are those who Besant, and those are those who prefer Leadbeater. But you have, nonetheless, still an openness to those elements. The third object, to investigate the hidden laws of nature, and then again the powers latent within humanity, I think this again was one of the key aspects that the Neoplatonists focused on. You know, how do you elevate yourself? The assumption again that these seeds are there within our nature. How do we bring them to being? How do we change our consciousness as such? The three fundamental propositions in the secret doctrine are, again, the first one speaking in terms of an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle that's unthinkable, unspeakable, and unknowable, the beingness itself. Well, when they speak of the one in that comes from Plotinus, you have the one all, the first, the simple, the absolute, the transcendence, the unconditioned, the infinite, the unknowable, the form of the good, the alone, various expressions, but all of it, again, pointing to a source that's really unknowable. I guess, you know, in Chicago in the 30s, they might have called it the untouchable, even. It's, that point had been reached, but nonetheless, there's the similarity, I think, between the first object. The second object where that we speak of in terms of the universal, for universality of the law of periodicity, the kind of cyclicity of life. I don't think, at least in what I've read so far and known, is that isn't something that has dwelled on by the Neoplatonists as such. I don't think they have a sense of the spiraling element of evolution that theosophy has, but again, I'm just reinvestigating that, so I'll report that to you on a later date as I go through some of these heavy tomes and find out to what degree it's there. The third one, the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, the latter being itself an aspect of the unknown root. Well, once again, I think this notion of reaching that oversoul, that is the kind of goal of the ascent, whether it be done through discipline philosophically or through theurgy, that seems to be a similar connection, even though, you know, as HBB puts it, is that this acquired individuality, first by natural impulses and then by self-induced and self-devised efforts, checked by karma, thus ascending, again, through all the degrees of intelligence, from the lowest to the highest manas, from mineral and plant, up to the holiest archangel, through personal effort and merit throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. So it seems to me, again, that the connection between the two is obvious, but it's not in totally necessarily going to fit a scheme one-to-one. And I'm going to be trying to deepen my understanding of that in the years to come as I go back over this material. So, in going back over in these first six parts, I'd like to just raise if there are any particular kind of questions, and then we'll get a chance to see the video for those who want to. Well, as it developed, I think in part more and more, first of all, there were the old Greek pantheon taken very metaphorically that were tied to the teachings at the time of the rising. And so again, these were other gods then, lesser gods, gods to be avoided. I think overall, though, at least if you look at certain sources, it became, one of, to some degree, a kind of a split in terms of education. The kind of Hellenic education that stressed the philosophers as being primary came across then people who were not as educated, who were finding comfort and finding their sense of connection with Christianity. And so more and more there became, a hostility to the kind of arguing that would have been involved in this tradition. Well, those things got absorbed in ways by Christian thinkers then. I mean, I think later on it was on the one hand, I think there were certain attitudes that just wanted to, that were totally against anything that was intellectual that came out of the traditions of Greece, just an anti-intellectualism. But later on, there were ways, people who adapted it and used it to their own means. But I think, as I go into, some of the historical writers of the period, this kind of wave of pessimism and despondency that existed in these centuries, a lot of people don't feel they have any clear idea why it happened that way. But on the one hand, you had, Christians being persecuted, by pagans, and then Christians persecuting other Christians and pagans, and then this kind of transformation over the period of time, and I think there's a lot of complex strands there that just studying philosophies alone is not going to clarify. But it's somewhat doubtful.
It wasn't just the Platonic ideas that was all
ideas. What?
Almost all ideas.
Oh yeah. I think again.
Dark Ages.
Well, the Dark Ages came out. We were considered a little bit later, but I think the at the time, though, and I think at least it seemed that most of the other philosophies, like Pythagoras and Aristotle, even by the time you reach the 3rd century, you can't find examples of people that are prominent teaching those as the dominant thought. That somehow still Plato, as visioned by the Neoplatonists, still goes onward. So he's sort of the last target, if you wish, as such. Yeah?
Why is it
said that Ammonius Sacchus? No, well, that's the rumor that comes through. Comes through in Porphyry's book. That's the first. That's the source of that, and that he was again in contact with the higher dimension. When you start reading Porphyry, the letter to Marcellus, I think the way he uses God in talking to his wife and instructing her sounds as Christian as could be, even though he used the major treatise against Christianity, but he's talking about virtue and development of the faculties in a very much in a monotheistic framework.
Does he give us any evidence for making that statement?
About only, of course, that he didn't know, but that was his teacher, Plotinus's teacher. So, of course, I mean, that's the thing, again, the critics in the 20th century are saying, of course, what you have from Porphyry, you have a hagiography of Plotinus. I mean, Plotinus is a saint. Plotinus, one of the stories that Plotinus likes to tell is that that Porphyry likes to tell is Plotinus was pretty dubious about what we would call the occult and those who had anything to do with spirits or divination, but apparently someone who was visiting from out of state came out of country came in and Porphyry brought him there, and Porphyry said that this visitor said that the daemon of Plotinus was actually a god, not just the normal level of a daemon that we might have here as such. And, you know, it apparently pleased pleased Plotinus, just as those who thought of him as being the reincarnation of Plato. You know, those things, you know, again, there's that element as such. What I would say is, again, just in getting to the present, is that when I, you know, when I first started, you know, studying Plotinus back in the early 60s, there really were only like two works in English about Plotinus. And now in the last, particularly in the last 10, 15 years, the bibliography is really growing. There's kind of an interest in academia in all of these people now. There was a conference at Vanderbilt in 96 that was the first major international conference on Neoplatonism, and I'm waiting to, you know, see the collection of papers, you know, be published by that group. But I think as we become more, have more access to these works, I think going back to the key to theosophy, these are our kindred spirits. I mean, they aren't going to necessarily correspond in word to word with HPB or anyone else in the tradition. I think there's an awful lot that we can, you know, gain in looking at them as well and reading them. So that would be the recommendation too for some of you who might be interested to take a look at some of this stuff, see if it clarifies the material to you. Any other questions? Then what I want to show you this video, and if any of you have seen it before, I have shown it. It's a little work on the allegory of the cave that was made out west a number of years ago, and in it, I think, you know, you'll see some of the elements, hopefully, that I've talked about today. And then I think, again, with the notion that whereas in the more optimistic time of Plato, the sense of the responsibility to the polis, the responsibility that the philosopher king would have, has been somewhat shifted as you get to these kind of darker ages. So you go away from more of a community responsibility to one that, in a sense, sometimes conveys personal transcendence as being prior to any true responsibility to others.